Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. I'm talking today with philosopher Simon Critchley about his book, Tragedy, the Greeks, and Us. Professor Critchley, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Andy.
So let's start with the big question. Why does tragedy still speak to us today?
Well, how do I begin? It does because it does, I suppose. It does because it does. It's the world that tragedy, ancient tragedy, and Elizabethan tragedy, and more recent ones speak out of is still legible to us. It makes sense to us. It has power over the way we think about things. Why that's the case is, in a way, is hard to understand. I'm not being evasive by that. I mean, there are people that like to read the Old Testament. I don't know that many of them. And there are some people that get, you know, excited by the Epic of Gilgamesh. It has its virtues, but I don't think any of those texts is you know, legible and then performable in the way that the classical tragedy is, or more recent tragedies are. So there's something going on in tragedy. It doesn't to make it relevant. It still speaks to who we are because we're not that different.
Right. Yeah, this was something of a problem for Marx, I think, you know, the idea of why do these plays from 2000 years ago speak to us so well if the material conditions of our society is so different. But I think part of what you're suggesting in this book is maybe...
That's why we shouldn't show another reason for not following Marx on any number of things. I mean, you know, material conditions explain they're partial explanatory factors of human situations, but they're not determining factors. Apart from in the minds of academic Marxists, of which there are legion numbers in the world. And so in a sense, the way classical tragedy, say, ancient tragedy, you know, it's Marx says it's in the introduction to the Grundrisse, isn't it? Which talks about that. It shouldn't make sense to us, but it does. And that's because it's great. And they were the infancy of humankind. Utter nonsense, Marx spouts when it comes to art. But that's by the by.
Well, I think that's an interesting question, though, because one of the things you seem to be arguing in your book is that the sort of ancientness of ancient tragedy has been overstated in a way, right? That it's not this sort of ritualistic, kind of pre-modern thing, but that it's actually... You know, it's the deliberation of a city trying to figure out very complicated ethical questions, right?
Not necessarily trying to figure out ethical questions. That's not clear. There were performances of plays in festivals. We know that. We don't know what they were for, whether they had any kind of moral purpose at all. In many ways, I'm skeptical about that. The fact that we desperately want to find a moral purpose in theatre says more about our deficiencies rather than what the Greeks were up to say. And tragedy is modern in its context. It's modern. It's an invention. Theater was an invention. It wasn't. I mean, again, some people like to think of another. Marx can give you all sorts of delusions. Nietzsche can give you other kinds of delusions that tragedy has its origin in Dionysian ritual. It doesn't. There's no evidence for that. It's something which is it's a form, theatre, where elements from the past, stories from the past, not always. There are actually historical events too. The oldest play we have, 472, Aeschylus's Persians, deals with a recent historical event. But often stories from the past are being presented through a new technology, a new format, in the form of theatre. So tragedy is an invention. I think that's the key thing to, which is not, so it's not some kind of ritualized performance. And to understand tragedy as ritual is to kind of deliberately misunderstand it. Although that was a fashionable approach about a century ago.
One of the other philosophers that you kind of take issue with is Aristotle. And yes. You seem to be a bit annoyed with Aristotle and his kind of smug self-certainty. So what exactly is it that kind of you recoil at in the Poetics?
Well, this book, Tragedy, the Greeks and Us, is it's an attempt to make the statement that if we want to understand ourselves understand ourselves better and where we are, we have to go back to theatre, to the stage of our lives. And that's what happens in comedy and in satire plays, but really powerfully in tragedy. And we have 31 of them in ancient Greek, and we understand those plays through different lenses, which we could talk about, but the main framing device that's often been used in the history of the understanding of theatre is Aristotle's Poetics. And it's somehow imagined that Aristotle was right about what he was up to, and that he was, and it's plausible, and we know what it means and things like that. And I try and show in a really kind of long discussion of Aristotle, which was really hard to write. It really was a lot of sweat trying to show how plays themselves, tragedies themselves, function as a kind of pre-buttle of what Aristotle was up to. They kind of they're more excessive, more extreme, wilder, more interesting than the kind of slightly domesticated saccharine stuff that Aristotle was talking about. And you can, I mean, one way of thinking about that would be around the issue of catharsis. People love the idea of catharsis. They think they know what it means. It's really not clear what it means in the Poetics, and it's not clear what its relationship to theatre is. And you pull that little plank away, then all sorts of interesting stuff happens.
Yeah, that does seem to be pretty central to most people's understanding of Aristotle, is the idea that there's some kind of a, you know, a sense of, is it a purgation? Is it a sort of release? It's completely unclear what that's supposed to mean, right?
Yes. I mean, the word is used in mainly in, you know, it's used once in the Poetics. It's not explained. It's used in the Politics with a reference to a lost poetical work. And then the other times it's used, and I catalogue these in the book, is in relationship to biological functions like going to the toilet or menstruation in the case of women. It's a kind of catharsis, is a kind of discharge. And a discharge. And if you think about it in those terms, which for some reason we find repellent, then you know, things begin to change. It's not as if we because linked to the idea of catharsis is the idea of well, maybe two ideas: the idea of us kind of identifying with a work of Thiessen. Again, there's no reason to believe any of that in relation to any of the ancient plays or indeed Shakespearean plays. And the idea that they're to do with education, right? They're to do with the education of citizens and things like that. Again, there's no evidence at all that that's in play. And then so you begin to prod at these concepts that are dear to us. And it's not just that catharsis is something which is fond, people that read Aristotle are fond of. It's something which people talk about all the time in relationship to, ordinary experiences of art. You know, they'll go and see a movie, and if you ask them, what do you think of the movie? Well, I felt kind of, there was a catharsis in it, which usually means some kind of, whatever, purification, elevation, education, all of that. And I'm not saying that that's wrong, but what's going on in theatre, and particularly in ancient theatre, is just much more devastating and much more profound than that. And that's something we can begin to get close to if we can push Aristotle. Read him is important, but push him outside, push him to one side a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm. That phrase, more devastating, that you use, I believe that's from Anne Carson, right?
Yes.
What have you learned? She's obviously an amazing poet and translator of these Greek plays. Mm-hmm. What have you learned from her work, and how has her work helped you in writing this book and in thinking about tragedy more generally?
Well, she's been very helpful. There's a story connected with that, which would be... for example, she translated the Antigone of Sophocles, and what she sought to do in the translation was to strip Antigone of the usual forms of identification, forms of emotion which we associate with it. The way the play is often read is in terms of, here is a young woman who's being brutalized by the forces of the state. It's what, in the way Brecht rewrites the play, and so on and so forth. She tries to strip all of that away and to leave us with a kind of cold presentation of the drama itself. And she, and it's an incredibly powerful translation, I think, because we look at plays, and we look at these plays with a cold, pensive distance. We're watching people's lives being torn to pieces, being devastated, and we look. We don't have to go there ourselves. Actors can go down to those places on our behalf, and we get to look. And when that show was, that translation was used in a performance of the Antigone at Brooklyn Academy of Music at BAM some years ago, Juliette Binoche was Antigone, which was a strange choice in many ways. And they, of course, the actors put all the emotion back in, and the consequence was the usual kind of melodrama that we associate with productions of classical plays. It was just, the usual kind of working of the emotions. And if you want that, then watch Geico ads or something, or watch basketball. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. I'm completely into that. But theatre is something else. And Anne Carson, I remember I had a conversation with her some years ago, because my approach is tragedy against philosophy and against our standard conceptions of morality. And at some point we were talking about catharsis, and she said, I've just got no idea what that word means. I said, nor have I. And so in a sense, the movement against catharsis is also something I borrow from Anne Carson. The last thing that I think is really important is that, why does tragedy exist? Let me put it a different way. Tragedy is a strange art form. A strange thing. It's not even an art form, strange thing. What takes place in tragedy? Well, there is rage. There's lots of rage, that's for sure. And the rage flows from grief. So if we think again about Antigone, she is to put it mildly, rather pissed off with the situation of her brother being not being allowed appropriate burial rights. And she is angry, and she's angry because of the grief that she's feeling and the context out of which that rage and grief arise is a context of war. And so one way of thinking about tragedy with Anne Carson is around these three terms, rage, grief, and war. That gets us closer to the phenomenon than kind of, you know, saccharine thoughts like catharsis, identification, and sympathy, it seems to me.
So how is war portrayed in these tragedies? That's one of the ways that I feel like tragedy has been kind of revisited lately, is in the context of, you know, the United States has been at war now for 20 years and kind mm-hmm. of looking to see, you know, there's a group called Theater of War that kind of started doing productions of Greek tragedies to kind of think through some yes. of the questions around what does it mean to be a country at war. How is war portrayed in these plays?
It's a good question. Brian Durries's work is interesting, and you know, I've enjoyed the productions I've seen over the years. It's still too moralistic and sentimental. It's not that we can just lift, you know, Antigone, say, and then it can become Antigone in Ferguson. It's not quite like that. It's not. So in a sense, there's a problem with that kind of approach. And it's there's too much pathos in a way, and the thing about theatre is that the pathos has to be, I don't know, how would I put this without wanting to sound offensive? It's the coldness, it's the coolness of theatre, which forces us to reflect on our actual real condition, and not to kind of wind us up into some kind of sentimental excitement where we believe we're doing something, but actually we're doing nothing at all. So war is a very good example of this whole set of questions. The first thing is that everybody would have known about war. The cities, Athens was constantly at war, and the cities around it were constantly at war. Usually with each other, if not with each other, with the Persians. And there was nothing bad about war, and there was nothing particularly good about war. War was just something that occurred. And the second thing, which I think is really interesting, is that the people that were the actors in these plays were people that had experienced war. They were veterans. They weren't, you know, kind of woolly-minded, you know, performance studies majors at expensive colleges in New York. They were people that had been involved in conflict, and therefore their view of war, I think, is different. It's both more informed, it's more subtle, and it's more, again, it's quite, in a sense, it's cooler as well. Not sense cooler of cool, but cooler in the sense of which it's not so kind of wound up mm-hmm. by what's going on. So it's the war is the context out of which theatre emerges, and it's not clear what theatre's relationship to war. I mean, obviously the comforting view would be to the idea that, you know, theatre is anti-war. That's not clear, just as that's not clear in you take any of the Shakespearean plays, just take Hamlet. Is that an anti-war play or a pro-war play? But there's war everywhere, and it's in that context of war and threats of war that ghosts appear and the whole drama begins to unfurl. So in a sense, we have to hang on to the idea of war, and not sort of imagine that we can that theatre is, you know, going to deliver us towards peace, because that's just not the case in relationship to plays, the Greek plays or more recent ones.
Yeah, when
Sorry,
I think
that
of
was got rather
no, no, that was, that. I think that was great. You know, that's something when I think about a play like Ajax, you know, that's not a play that I would describe necessarily anti-war, but it's maybe a kind of romanticized version of war. You know, the idea that it's sweet to die for your country or something like that. That'd be a very hard view to sustain, you know, through a production of a play like Ajax.
Yeah. It's against romanticizations of war. And that's very important. And also I think the lesson that I, one lesson I take from ancient Greek tragedy is the idea that although this is a historical accident, the oldest play that we have, Persians by Aeschylus, 472 roughly, is all that happens in that play is that we see Persians lamenting because they've been defeated. News of their defeat has got back to them. And then the drama, there's not very much drama in the play, really, but Xerxes returns, the defeated general returns, and the ghost of Darius, the great former leader of the Persians, is summoned to admonish him and give a lesson to the Greeks. The point of the play, it would appear, is that it's not a victory dance by the Athenians, right? The Athenians are, they don't exactly defeat the Persians. The Persians kind of give up. The Greeks are clearly, you know, not going to buckle under their pressures. The Greeks kind of, the Persians kind of give up. But for the Greeks, this is very important. But they depict, the Persians are depicted with sympathy, I think, as just people who are suffering like the way Greeks suffer. They're dressed differently. They speak differently. They have different names, but they're people like we're people. So the idea, and also there's a wonderful moment when the ghost of Darius the Great appears, and he says to Xerxes, his son, who's failed in his military campaign, he doesn't admonish him for defeat. He admonishes him for desecrating the altars of the Greeks. This is an impious act. So he criticizes his son for his impiety. And then he says, and this is the extraordinary moment in this play, Darius, the ghost of Darius the Great, addresses the audience. Obviously an audience is watching this in 5th century Athens, addresses the audience and says to the Greeks, if you do anything like this, if you engage in acts of impiety, then you'll come to a similar end to Xerxes. So there's this strange kind of address in a play like Persians around the question of war. But there's no idea that war is going to end or that it's, you know, or that it's doing anything. It's just what human beings do when human beings are in a competition for power, usually. That's why the great documenter of war is Thucydides, and Thucydides' accounts of the Peloponnesian War, which have direct correlation with a whole number of Greek plays.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary thing for a playwright to do, to depict the other side of a victorious war.
Well, for us it is, but not for them. And that says how, in a sense, how little progress there's been in 3 millennia, which is kind of the point. You know, it's the, I think that the, I mean, the real riddle of tragedy, the real enigma of tragedy for me is why it's still legible, why it still speaks to us, makes a claim on us, because it does. And how that claim is also similar to the claim that other kinds of theatre can make on us. I don't see. So what people like to do at that point is they like to divide up history into neat historical bundles like antiquity and modernity and postmodernity and all of that. I have no interest in historical narratives in particular. The peculiar thing about theatre and about tragedy is that it's as if like a kind of a ghost, you know, once it's summoned, it can take on a very similar form and have a very similar kind of effect. So for me, to go from Sophocles to Shakespeare to Ibsen to Beckett or whatever is not a huge leap. It's not as if tragedy dies the way some people argued, like George Steiner in a very silly book a long time ago. But the, you know, it's that tragedy is it's a kind of art form that happens in between times, when a form of the world is kind of passing away and a new form of the world is coming into existence, and somehow theatre is able to span those moments, like moments like, say, Elizabethan London, and speak to us. But that can be revived. So I don't think that, to that extent, I'm extraordinarily optimistic about theatre, because theatre can you know, can wreak its havoc, can cause its effects in a whole number of different circumstances, and also can take different forms. I think that there's no reason why it has to be restricted to what takes place in a theatre, although that's very nice. And at this point in the pandemic, seems like a crazy dream, doesn't it? But it can happen in movies too, and other media.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the kind of running themes in your book is that you really take issue with the way that philosophy has understood tragedy, and not just particular philosophers, but kind of philosophy yeah. as a discipline. You seem to, I almost wonder if it's kind of an original sin in philosophy that it misunderstands tragedy so gravely. Could you talk a bit about kind of what is yes. the nature of that misunderstanding? What does philosophy get wrong, and why can't it seem to, you know, understand tragedy in the way that you'd want it to?
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, a good question. And there has to be a slightly, slightly long answer. But, you know, there is, for reasons, again, that we do not understand. But it just is the case. It happened. Athens invented a few things. It invented theatre in the way that we understand it on the south slope of the Acropolis, the theatre of Dionysus. And in that theatre, tragedies, comedies, satyr plays were performed. Sometime later, although the city Dionysia, which was the festival where the plays were first produced, was sponsored by a tyrant, Pisistratus. You know, the other thing that Athens invents is this thing called democracy, which emerges in the early years, the reformers of Cleisthenes. It takes on different forms, but there it is. So the 5th century BC, whatever we think about that period, there is theatre, particularly tragedy, and there's democracy. And there's some connection between those two things. Not that tragedy is democratic, I'm not saying that, but the two things are linked, and they take place not very far from each other, which itself is very interesting, that the theatre is, you know, is, I don't know, half a mile from the, you know, the council, and from the Pnyx, where democratic decisions were made. So philosophy, and by philosophy, I mean that that's a practice that Plato calls philosophy. That's the term. We can say, well, philosophy has always existed. There have always been people with philosophical views. That's fine and that's true. But philosophia, as a term, is introduced by Plato, or Plato's, the people that are writing these thoughts down, almost certainly not Plato. But the and Plato, using the a number of things to say. Firstly, Platonic dialogue or Socratic dialogue is drama. It's a form of drama in itself, the form of a dramatized dialogue between Socrates often and some interlocutors. Secondly, philosophy is consistently, persistently anti-democratic, right? As well as being misogynistic in different ways, but it's anti-democratic. Democracy is singled out for withering critique in Plato's Republic. And the argument being that democracy looks nice. It looks, you know, nicely colored, as the word that Plato uses, a many colored and kind of fair garment, but it leads to the emergence of tyranny. Tyrants are what democracy produces. And then the argument is that theater and tragedy in particular is really in cahoots with tyranny and with the bad elements, the bad populist elements of democracy. And that's why in the kind of city that Plato tries to imagine in the mouth of Socrates in Republic, in that city, there can be no theater, there can be no tragedy. And the reasons for that then get really, really quite detailed. And it's about the amount of emotion that tragedy seems to pull up in people, in particular the emotion of grief and lamentation. Plato is dead set against that. That's bad. So the invention of philosophy is done at the expense of democracy and at the expense of theatre. And they have to get, in order for this new form of drama to appear, Socratic dialogue, the old form of drama has to be not just killed, it has to be excluded from the minds of the people that will end up governing the city, the guardians. They should not be allowed to visit theatre. And this is an issue which rumbles down through the centuries, right? Mm-hmm. Think about Rousseau's argument against Voltaire in the 1750s, 60s, about whether there should be a theatre in Geneva. And Rousseau says, no. Once you've got a theatre, you've got representation. Once you've got representation, people begin to, you know, they get too wound up, too excited by this drama, and they're lost. And so there's a very, very strong anti-theatrical tradition in philosophy, which is which I'm trying to kind of show and then very strongly argue against by saying that we need to, if we're interested in the deep, searching questions about who we are, what we are, and things like that, then we would do much better going to theatre than studying philosophy. and of course, the other part of that is that I'm someone that has spent their career teaching in philosophy departments, so there's also a kind of extra spice in this for me. I think that the way philosophers talk about artworks in general and theatre in particular is to say the least challenged, and needs to be deeper and richer and more informed with more examples.
Do you think it's possible to extend that criticism further beyond art and say that philosophy tends to be a sort of categorizing, reductive discipline in general that pays too little attention to the particulars of the thing it's actually pretending to study?
Yes. Yes. And I think, and if it were only philosophy, that would be fine. I mean, who cares? You've got, you know, a bunch of, you know, overeducated people teaching books that very few people have read. I mean, you know, why does it matter? But the point is deeper than that, in the sense in which philosophy here, what is philosophy? And this is where I, in the book, it's not addressed directly, but I've got Nietzsche on my mind. I've got Nietzsche is a, you know, a very complex figure for me. There's a Nietzsche that I very much like, and a Nietzsche that I think is wildly wrong. But the Nietzsche that I really like talks about the prejudices of the philosophers, and the prejudices of the philosophers can be reduced to really two. The idea that with the use of the intellect or reason, we can peer into the nature of that which is, right? So that with the mind, we can find out that which is. That's what philosophers would call ontology, right? An account of being. And on that basis of what is, the second prejudice would be that philosophers can offer certain moral injunctions. They can tell you what you ought to do, what is good and what is bad in relationship to what is. And those two prejudices are, for Nietzsche, laughable. And if it were just philosophers, well, who cares? But the thing is, the world is full of people who think they know what is, and they think the mind can peer into the nature of existence, you know, substance, nature, whatever it might be. And on that basis, give nice moral instructions. Do this, don't do that. Or doing this will lead to justice. Doing that will lead to injustice. Now, whatever is going on in classical tragedy and in modern tragedy, whatever is going on is not that. We're not presented with a settled account of what is, and with a settled account of what we should do. For me, it's exactly the opposite. The extraordinary thing about Greek tragedies is that there is deep uncertainty about the nature of existence. It could be these gods, it could be that gods, it could be this way of doing things, it could be that way of doing things. Maybe the Egyptians are right, maybe the Persians are right. We don't know. It's play, and it plays out in the plays as conflict, as discursive conflict, an argument, and also the nature of morality and moral action is also deeply ambiguous in these plays. So one thing that I try and argue in the book is that what defines tragedy is moral ambiguity and a division around the nature of the good and the bad. And if we began to approach the world in those terms, then we'd be in a very different place, it seems to me. So it's not that philosophy gets things wrong. It plays out these prejudices. It's rather that whole human societies do exactly the same thing. And so people think they know what is the case and what justice is and what they should do. And what you see in a play is someone who is destroyed by such beliefs, usually. Mm-hmm. Oedipus is very clear about what is the case and what he should do and who he is. And we see him destroyed. That's what tragedy does. It shows people devastated by the certainties which they previously had. I think that's the power of theater, right? For me.
Yeah. I think one of the kind of related misunderstandings that people often have, and it's either, you know, whether they think it's in Aristotle or not, I think is less relevant, but just the idea that what a tragedy does is shows you a character that has some flaw, and then the flaw destroys them, and then the audience says, well, okay, I'll try not to have that flaw, and maybe I'll make it out alive, right? Mm-hmm. Which I gather is another sort of wildly simplistic understanding of tragedy that you take issue with. Could you talk a bit about why that common idea of the tragic flaw is so mistaken?
It's not a flaw. It's that there is I think it's more that there's an idea of limitedness, an idea of limitedness, which for me is hugely important. The idea that human beings are unlimited, have unlimited potential, unlimited capacity for growth, for this or that, is a terrible ideological lie. We are creatures who are weak, wretched, limited, and to that extent, you know, flawed. And what we see on stage is that, right? And we're not shown that in order to correct it. We're shown how that plays out. And it's not clear why. I mean, so a thing I mentioned maybe a little bit earlier, but it's quite dear to me, is the idea that we have that theatre is good because it educates people. And this is what was going on with Greek drama. It educated the citizens. There's absolutely no evidence for that. It's rather the case that the people that would have gone to see these plays were already educated. They knew what was what. So what they were looking at in the plays was something else, some kind of almost exaggerated kind of night view of their situation played out dramatically for the purposes of pleasure. Right, we should never forget that this is meant to arouse pleasure, and there is a pleasure in feeling pity and terror. Right, so if tragedy is, as Aristotle says, if tragedy is arousing these emotions, then we kind of enjoy that, but we don't enjoy it for a purpose. We enjoy it, as it were, as an activity in and of itself, and this can lead us to a kind of a more honest idea of what's going on in tragedy. I mean, you know, there is a belief, right? And coming from where I come from originally, that, you know, like Guinness, Shakespeare is good for you, right? It's just not clear to me what that means. It's not good for you in the sense in which the more Shakespeare you read, the better person you will be. It's not that simple, right? The lessons that, if indeed there are lessons, the things that are going on in these plays are just much more complex. And also the fact that we take pleasure, that we will watch someone be destroyed or destroy themselves, and we look at that coldly, coolly, is in a sense a strange and alarming thing to do. And I don't know, in terms of theatrical, I don't know what the best way of putting this, but what I'm thinking of in this book, I remember giving a presentation years ago somewhere, and it was in Boston, I think. And someone said, well, what you're arguing for is epic theatre in Brecht, right? Mm-hmm. And
I had that thought as well.
Right. And I said, yes, no, I'm not quite sure what you mean. I need to go back and look at that again. But indeed, that's right. I mean, epic theatre in Brecht, I mean, the idea that he has, you know, after the First World War and in the 20s, in a sense, before we get the really political Brecht, is an idea of theatre that is that shakes up the audience's expectations, kind of gets them to try and wake up, right? I think there's a kind of tendency that we have as theatregoers to kind of fall asleep in the theater, to switch off. Even if we're not asleep, we've kind of switched off. And what Brecht wanted was a theater of intelligence, and a theater where the spectator would be, the spectator would be a kind of observer with what was going on on stage, and where, you know, any kind of smooth narrative flows in the drama would become interrupted, kind of broken. So I think of Brecht's theatre of the 20s as a kind of almost like a theatre of fits and starts and sort of jump shots, and if you think about that in relationship to, say, Euripides, who's kind of the hero of the book, Euripides is the guy for me. Aeschylus and Sophocles, very nice indeed, but Euripides is really where it's at, because Euripides is taking the previous forms of drama, Aeschylus and Sophocles, and ridiculing them. It's a kind of meta theatre in Euripides. But the idea of epic theatre as a theatre which calls for and requires intelligence, which doesn't lead to a kind of simple catharsis, that is where the human situation is examined in a full kind of unforgiving, naked light, is really what I think is going on in Greek tragedies. And therefore I think you can put, you know, without wanting to sound ridiculously arrogant, but this is still going to sound ridiculously arrogant. I mean, I'd like to put myself in a tradition of thinking about theatre that you can find in people like Peter Brook, The Empty Space, you know, some of the remarks that Grotowski made, and then in theatre groups, and in my personal favourite, because they're local and I've been watching them for a long time, at the Worcester Group. Mm-hmm. And what the Worcester Group do with a classical drama like Hamlet or Troilus and Cressida is the kind of thing that I want to happen with theatre. That's what's going on. And it's not that that is timeless. It's not that's silly, but that still can occur. When that occurs, it can occur. And it's not tied to a specific place and time. It's something which is remarkably robust and translatable. So to that extent, I'm an optimist about theatre. And also I think that what's going on in this is helpful for your auditors would be let me try and get this right, because it's been some years since I wrote this book, and my mind's been occupied with other things, as is often the case. But I remember there's a story I tell at the end of the book, and I was doing this this event at BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, with Isabelle Huppert. And it was around a production of a play called Phaedrus, right? This, which was basically taking all these different versions of the same play from Euripides, Seneca, Racine, and Sarah Kane, and kind of melding them into some new form. Itself really interesting. And I had a talk with a public talk with her. I was a bit nervous. Actually, I was a bit ill that day. I remember I was pretty sick. I kept asking questions, and you know, she was being quite polite. And then she said something like, these are ideas you've got. They're maybe good ideas, but they're just ideas. And she said, what theatre is about is aliveness. It's a certain experience of aliveness. And that's really what I want to kind of, to hammer home, that there's something that takes place. It doesn't only take place in theatre, but it does take place in theatre when it happens, where you are held out. You are held out, kind of ecstatically held there, watching something on stage, which is usually awful, right? It's usually awful what's happening on stage. And you're held there, and for that period of time, your moral views of the world, your sense of who you are, what's right, what's wrong, all of that is suspended. It's just put to one side, and you're held there and you watch something. And that what you're watching there can be thought of as an idea of aliveness. But of course, that aliveness is also shot through with mortality and with deathness as well. So, I mean, going back to Anne Carson, there's a, this might be a way of kind of, putting a couple of things together, because as I'm speaking to you, actually remembering what it was I was saying in the book, it's coming back to me now. It's the, in that conversation I had with Anne Carson about catharsis, and I said, and she said, well, I don't know what it means. I said, well, I don't, people seem very fond of it. She said something like this story, that it's like walking down a road in Detroit. So you have to imagine Ann Carson walking down a road in Detroit. I mean, she was teaching at the University of Michigan for a long time. Hard to imagine, but let's imagine walking down a road in Detroit, ways to turn the story. And then she realizes that she's walking past a foundry where they are, there's molten metal, which is being forged in the, you know, made in the foundry, molten metal in the foundry. And she, as she's walking down the road, she looks to the left and sees this foundry and sees this, this fiery molten core. And then she turns back to the road and carries on walking. And she says, that's what theater's like. For a moment, if you're lucky, you get to see that burning core of aliveness and other stuff. And you can be, and you can hold it there for a second. What we take from that, what that means is a, you know, is a topic to be debated, but the philosophers got all that wrong, I think, roughly and readily.
Wonderful. I think that's a great moment to end our discussion of tragedy. I just want to give you a moment because you mentioned this book is a few years old now. It came out in 2019. And I understand you have a new book out. Is it this week?
Yeah, funnily enough.
Tell us a bit about that book?
Yes. Well, so the tragedy book is really, just to say, what that was, I mean, it's the fruit. I mean, books always taken, you know, several lifetimes to write. So I've been thinking about theater since I was, you know, since I was a student, and I'm not exactly from a theatrical background. So this has kind of been 30 years of kind of pondering the nature of theater and tragedy, and my mind has changed a lot. So although it's, you know, it feels old, it's still very much there with me. And I want to, for me, something absolutely powerful and unique happens in theatrical experience, and it's impossible to explain what that thing is, really, but that's what sometimes happens, and often it doesn't, because the theatre can be really bad, as we know. Anyway, but the new book I've got is called Bald, and or I guess Bald would be closer here, and it's 35 philosophical shortcuts. It's all the pieces I've written for the New York Times in the last 12 years. And it's a kind of way of tying all that work up into a neat bow and pushing it out there with a little simple, silly frame, which is about sticking your head out in public. So it's an idea of baldness as a, because it is funny when you're bald, but people feel they can say, they can point it out, right? Whereas if you pointed out other aspects of way somebody looked, their weight or their ethnicity, you know, you'd be looked at askance, but baldness is up for grabs. I'm just using that as a pretext for the way I've been trying to write for the New York Times for a number of years, which is in a bald, jargon-free, straightforward way, which means sticking your head out of the window. And of course, when you stick your head out the window, then you know, there are birds circling overhead and they're going to drop some unpleasantness on your head, but that's the way it is. And yes, that came out this week.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for being on New Books and Performing Art, Simon Critchley. I really enjoyed the book and I really enjoyed getting to talk with you about it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.